We are talking once again with Job Parrish and Maria Tomchik, local writers and activists, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
So, just a few days until the big gets off on Tuesday.
Yeah, and Wednesday and Thursday and Friday.
Yes.
And yeah.
Yes. Yeah, I think it's really important, and we'll probably stress this again later in the show, too, that people think of November 3rd not just as Election Day, but the whole month of November as election season.
Yeah, and I think maybe then into December as well. It's going to take a while to resolve.
That's possible, yes. So we just wanted to remind people of how to vote. If you've received a ballot in the mail and you haven't voted yet, mark it, sign the envelope, and take it to a drop box. Do not put it into the mail because there's no guarantee it will be postmarked by Election Day. And if it's not postmarked by Election Day, it won't get counted if it's not received by Election Day. There are drop boxes at community centers and a lot of public library branches, so they should be fairly easy to find.
Yeah, or you can go to the King County website also, King County Elections.
Yeah.
And that has the full list. There's about 120.
The full list, yeah. There are the ballot drop boxes are open 24 hours a day until 8 p.m. on Tuesday. So drop off your ballot there. You can still register to vote and pick up a ballot or get a replacement ballot if you haven't received yours in the mail at voter registration offices. And King County's voter registration office is at 919 Southwest Grady Way in Renton. But King County has also opened 6 additional locations for same-day registration and voting starting today. Those locations are CenturyLink Field Event Center at 800 Occidental Avenue South here in Seattle, one north of the Ship Canal at University of Washington Dempsey Indoor Center at 3833 Walla Walla Road Northeast. That's just northeast of Husky Stadium off of Montlake Boulevard. And then the others, the Bellevue College Gym at 3000 Landerholm Circle Southeast, the Federal Way Performing Arts and Event Center, is also has an in-person voting office. The Kenmore City Hall also does, and Showwear Center at 625 West James Street in Kent. So if you haven't registered to vote and you want to vote, you can still do that. The voter centers will be open from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. on Saturday today. They'll be closed tomorrow, but they'll be open again 8:30 to 6 p.m. on both Monday and Tuesday. And I suggest if you want to do that, that you go today or Monday. Wear a mask and look for signs and markings to maintain social distancing. Okay. And then I just wanted to give a little reminder about the 3 races that people keep asking me about. You know, I keep getting emails and requests from people, who should I vote for in these 3 races? For lieutenant governor, where 2 Democrats are running, former congressional representative for the 10th District, Denny Heck, is running against former state representative Marco Leas. Leas has more experience of statewide politics than Olympia, although they're both really good candidates. I think Leas would be more effective with his more recent experience in Olympia. And he's more knowledgeable about the issues that matter for the state Democrats. Heck's stint in the U.S. House of Representatives has probably pulled him more to the right, as it does for many, many Democrats who serve in the National Democratic Party. So Leas is the progressive choice in the lieutenant governor's race.
That's a really important race, because if Inslee winds up taking a position, say, in the Biden administration, that would mean that the acting lieutenant governor would become the acting governor until there's a special election. So that would mean that either Heck or Leas becomes the acting governor. So it's an more important race than usual for lieutenant governor.
Yeah, and because Inslee ran for president and he ran as the climate change candidate, it's very possible he could be tapped to fulfill some kind of role like that, like overseeing the EPA or something in a Biden administration. So, Lieutenant Governor.
He's getting mentioned for Interior also.
Yeah. So lieutenant governor is an important race this year. Now, there's two district house races that people keep asking me about, too, where there are two Democrats running. One is District 11, that's South Seattle, Tukwila, and South Renton. Position 1 has two Democrats, former Amazon and Microsoft employee Zach Hudgens and the more progressive David Hackney. So Hackney is the progressive choice. Hudgens is the incumbent, and he's done okay in Olympia, but again, I think Hackney has the more progressive positions.
And that's a majority-minority district, and, you know, Hudgens is a white guy, and Hackney is an African-American, so he is more representative of the district demographically, and he is more progressive, as Maria says also.
Yeah, and then the other race, the final race that people keep asking me about is actually in my own district, District 36, Queen Anne, Magnolia, and Ballard. Position 2 has a choice between two very good Democrats, Liz Berry and Sarah Reinfeld. Liz Berry's getting a lot of press and a lot of attention, and she's been getting a lot of money from outside the city of Seattle for her campaign. Reinfeld, however, is the progressive here. She's the woman with a plan, and she has endorsements from local progressives like Guillermo Zahale, Andrew Lewis, Bob Hasegawa, Nick Licata, Teresa Mosqueda, and other local progressives. So Reinfeld is the local favorite, and she's the progressive choice in that very close and very interesting race in my own district.
I would add to that the 37th, where Kirsten Harris-Talley is running against Jacundi Salisbury, and Salisbury is picking up a lot of late endorsements. He's very, again, two very good progressive Democrats. Kirsten Harris-Talley has some name recognition from her stint as an interim city council member 2 years ago. She, 3 years ago, sorry, it was during the initial 2017 head tax fight. She acquitted herself very well in that situation, even though she was sort of thrown into the maelstrom of a budget process with a controversial proposal. And we have some of those going on this year too, as we'll talk about shortly. But, she acquitted herself well. She had a lot of early endorsements. I think she's probably the stronger candidate, but again, that's another race where it's hard to go wrong.
Yeah, Salisbury's been working hard to try to get a feel for his district. So, he could turn out to be a really good representative for his district. So that's a tough decision there in that district. Either one of those candidates is good. And, we've said that Kirsten Harris-Talley is the better candidate because of her experience. So, you know, that's something to weigh.
But again, when you're
casting your vote.
Salisbury has been active in the district for like 20 years. He's well-grounded in the community also, as is Harris-Talley. So yeah. It's a tough choice.
It's a tough choice.
Oh, to have more tough choices like that.
Yeah, no kidding.
Why can't that be mirrored at the national level?
Yeah, wouldn't that be nice?
Anyway, yeah.
Yeah. And I'm sure we'll be I will have you can go for our full list of recommendations and analysis. We went through the whole ballot a couple of weeks ago on this show, so you can go to the archives for that. I will have the list of Dropbox locations, the link to that, and recommendations on my Facebook page, so you can check that out this afternoon. By all means, get out and vote, especially at the national level. This is a vote for whether you want democracy in this country or not. You know, flawed as it is, the system that we have is way better than the system we'll have if Donald Trump has another 4 years. So, get out and vote if you haven't done so already. And more than 50% of, registered Seattle voters have already voted. So that's very encouraging. It's going to be an enormous turnout. We're seeing that nationally as well. We'll talk about that in a bit too.
Yeah. We also want to talk too about what to do after the polls close on November 3rd.
Yeah.
There's been a lot of talk in the media and on social media about what regular folks should do after the polls close if our current president tries to declare himself the winner before all the votes are counted. And especially if he tries to stay in office, even though it's clear he has not won a majority of votes or even a majority of electoral votes.
And I would say the chances of that are nearly 100%.
Yeah, there are groups organizing a response for this possibility. Group action, I think, will be very important, and it's important that those groups be committed to nonviolent action. One such group is Choose Democracy, which you can find more info about online at choosedemocracy.us. They are asking people to be ready to hit the streets on Wednesday, November 4th and Saturday, November 7th to demand that all the votes be counted before a winner is determined. By hit the streets, of course, they mean marching, chanting, singing, nonviolent resistance, not property destruction, and not violence against individuals. So leave weapons at home. But they also mean that people should be demanding that everyone respect the democratic process and count all the votes. Now, here in Seattle, Mobilize and Stand Up America are planning to hold daily marches starting Wednesday, November 4th at 5 p.m. People will convene at Occidental Park in Seattle, just the south end of downtown. Each night will take a different route for the march. The unified message will be and should be count every vote, protect every person. Protect the Results is another group is holding a national day of action in Seattle at noon. The location will be announced via text message and email. You can sign up for those text messages online at mobilize.us. They're also holding a Wednesday, November 4th rally from 3:30 to 4:30 p.m. at Rainier Avenue South and MLK Way South. So they're doing a rally at noon on Saturday and a rally at from 3:30 to 4:30 p.m. at Rainier Avenue South and MLK Way South the day after the vote. Local socialist groups will be hosting a rally, Don't Let Trump Steal the Election, at Westlake Park on November 4th at 6 p.m., the day after polls close. That includes Socialist Alternative, the Freedom Socialists, FSP, and the SDA, or DSA, sorry, Democratic Socialists of America, the Seattle chapter. And the UAW Local 4121 is also sponsoring that event. There's also a Greenlight group, Day After Day, Demand Trump Pence Out Now. And they've been holding rallies every day at 5 p.m. on weekdays and at 4 p.m. on weekends at Green Lake Park at the corner of East Green Lake Way North and Northeast 71st Street. And undoubtedly, they will be out on the streets the day after the vote. And, of course, there will be a lot of spontaneous stuff going on. The important thing is that it be nonviolent, that folks insist on the Republicans following electoral law, counting every vote and waiting to declare a winner until all the votes have been counted and allowing that every vote be counted. That could take a while, as we said. It could take weeks or it could take a couple months.
Yeah, I think Trump is likely to try and appeal all the way to the Supreme Court. This is an election where the margin matters, because if the protests are nonviolent and if there's a very clear majority for Biden, you know, Trump can claim that the vote was rigged all he wants, but without any evidence to back that up, the courts are very unlikely to side with him, including, I hope, the Supreme Court. But we'll find out whether that institution stands or not. I've been working behind the scenes for the past couple of months with George Lakey and some other folks at the national level talking about the response for different groups. There have also been several unions, including in Seattle, that are calling for a general strike.
Work stoppage is another way to show your willingness to your unwillingness to just go along with whatever Donald Trump decides.
Yeah, and
not
I hope,
just being out on the street.
Yeah, and I hope we'll get to it in this hour if we have time. But there have been a number of international situations recently where people show how it's done. Poland is having that right now after their Supreme Court, which is very similarly authoritarian to the United States leadership, decided to ban abortion. And so there's an enormous women's movement going on in Poland right now that is stopping the country. And if you remember, that was the catalyst for the fall of the Iron Curtain, was work stoppages in Poland 30 years ago. So that has a history there. We've seen Belarus going on for months and months, where the authoritarian leader there is having a hard time keeping a grip on his country because of outrage over the result of fraudulent elections. Same thing in Kyrgyzstan with fraudulent elections there for the last couple of weeks. So this happens in other parts of the world, and we need to start paying attention to what those movements are doing and the tactics that are working. They really, really, and this is something that the group I've been working with George Lakey and others, has been emphasizing, has to be nonviolent, because it's going to be a question of legitimacy for the general public, for the people who aren't out there on the streets. And if it's nonviolent in this country, culturally, it's legitimate. If it's violent, culturally, it's very easy to discredit it. And, you know, not to mention that the opposition is likely to try and resort to violent tactics.
Yeah, so, and if it's violent, the courts may side with Trump. So it's very important for it to be nonviolent.
Yeah, totally agree.
Mm-hmm.
That was a cheerful way to start the show.
That was, but people need to be thinking about what would you do.
Yeah, absolutely. You know? And making plans. Not just making a plan for your vote, because a lot of people have already done that, but what's going to happen when the
polls close?
When the poop hits the fan on Wednesday, yeah.
Yeah. And that first 24 hours is going to be really key. A lot of people will have the reaction of, I don't know what to do, I don't know what to do, and they freeze, you know, and end up eventually just doing nothing. But doing nothing the day after the vote is a vote for whatever Donald Trump decides, and you can't do that. So
it's a vote for fascism. Yeah.
It's important to think now about what you'll be doing on that day.
I think it's really important that we have public demonstrations in support of democracy and in support of a fair process. And because if we don't, then that's a vote for essentially a white supremacist dictatorship, and that increases the chances that that's what we'll wind up with. That is part of the voting process this year.
Yeah.
It's unfortunate, but it is.
Let's move on to developments with the city council.
Yeah, the Seattle City Council is in the middle of their budget process for the 2021 budget. And this week they discussed a slew of amendments to Mayor Durkan's proposed budget. There are some very interesting trends. And rather than talk about specific amendments, I wanted to, because there are so many of them, I wanted to talk about the trends. And overall, the amendments really show a council that's hard at work to do some of the things that the mayor should be doing, but hasn't been. For example, making sure that there's adequate money in the budget for equitable investment projects by restoring the promised $30 million from the Mercer Mega Block sale, which Mayor Durkan canceled from the 2021 budget and was going to use to plug budget hole elsewhere. The city council is planning to restore that funding as it was promised. Other things they're doing is more money for shelter for the homeless, money to continue the new outreach team to get people out of tent encampments, the new outreach team that is not the navigation team, which simply swept encampments, money for legal assistance to renters when the COVID-19 eviction moratorium is lifted, and COVID relief programs that the council funded in 2020, but that Mayor Durkan cut in the 2021 budget, and there are a lot of them. Now, the council is also showing that it's serious about setting up and funding a civilian 911 team to respond to nonviolent 911 calls. And there are several amendments that relate to setting up a new community safety and communications center. But the council also recognizes that it's going to take some time to get this up and running, that just allocating the funds for it and passing a separate bill to set it up is not going to cover all of the city's needs for 911 calls. The council wants to move several Seattle Police Department units out of the SPD and into the new Community Safety and Communications Center. Those units are the Parking Enforcement Unit, Community Service Officers, the Office of Emergency Management, and the 911 Call Center itself. Now, this is similar to changes that were proposed by Mayor Durkan, who would have moved parking enforcement into the Department of Transportation and the other units into Seattle Emergency Communications Center. So essentially they're saying, okay, good idea. This is what we're going to do, but we're going to group it all together with the 911 civilian team and put it in its own new department. In addition to moving those units, which makes up about 12% of the Seattle Police Department's budget, the council is defunding the SPD by about 6% next year, not 50%. And the number of personnel, both sworn officers and civilians in the Seattle Police Department, will be cut by about 21%, not 50%, once all these changes are made. And this is just the first step in a shift that the council clearly is expecting will take at least 3 to 5 years, if not more. Okay. To that end, they have a number of amendments that require the Seattle Police Department to provide more reports to the city council on everything from 911 calls to how much overtime police officers are working and what they're doing with that overtime. Now, the reporting is clearly meant to inform further decisions down the road about what units can be cut or transferred to the civilian 911 response team in future budget years, like in 2022, 2023, and 2024. Now, I should mention here that Shama Sawant did propose an amendment to cut the SPD by 50%, but she didn't get any other council members to sign on to it. And these amendments at this stage in the budget process, the council is only considering amendments that have at least 3 council members as sponsors. Now, the council will free up about $21.5 million from the Seattle Police Department next year by making those 6% cuts that they can then allocate to community-led public safety efforts. But they're also yanking back that $100 million that Durkan pulled from the Jumpstart payroll tax to spend on her own initiatives for the BIPOC community. The council clearly wants that money to be spent on that money from the Jumpstart tax to be spent on COVID-19 relief. And they passed an entire bill, saying what the Jumpstart tax, money should be spent on. And that said that in the first year to 2 years, it needs to go first to COVID-19 relief. So this is the council acting on that law, which Mayor Durkan completely ignored when she drafted her budget. And those COVID-19 relief funds, I should remind people, include everything from food programs to education programs for kids learning from home to public health and to hygiene programs, as well as housing, trying to get the homeless off the street into shelters where they're safe from contracting COVID-19. Now, there's even an amendment in the budget to extend the B&O tax credit to small businesses with revenue of less than $200,000 per year. The current credit is for businesses with less than $100,000 in revenue per year. So they're doubling that and allowing other small businesses, which are really struggling and starting to close because of the economic downturn and because of the stay-at-home order. A lot of those small businesses are really suffering, and so the city council is trying to extend relief to them as well. This is clearly a COVID-19 relief proposal for the business community as well. And there are many, many, many amendments allocating funding to programs for communities of color, and not just from Shama Sawant and Tammy Morales, but every single one of the city council members have proposed some amendments to the budget that would spend money for BIPOC communities. Now, one key amendment would add funding for a Green New Deal advisor position to get the Green New Deal advisory board up and running in 2021. This amendment was proposed by Shama Sawant and co-sponsored by Tammy Morales and Alex Peterson, not folks you'd normally consider as allies on the city council.
Especially Peterson, yeah.
Yeah. Notably, Sawant points out in her amendment that the Green New Deal Advisory Board is supposed to give recommendations to the city council and the mayor's office about how to spend a portion of the revenue from the Jumpstart payroll tax starting in 2022. So the board needs to be put together in 2021. Mayor Durkan had cut all funding for that position and had not allocated any funding in her budget to get the board started. This amendment really looks like housekeeping, picking up after the mayor and her budget team because they're just not doing their job when they drafted the budget this year.
I think the trend is that mm-hmm. Durkin simply doesn't fund the things she doesn't agree with from city council.
Yeah, and it doesn't matter if there's a law in the books saying that she has to. She's just
Exactly.
Yeah, just ignores it. And so then the city council has to step in and do house cleaning and pick up after her, essentially. So it creates a lot of work for them. The overall impression you get then is one of a really hardworking city council with very clear priorities. That's working long hours to clean up after the mayor, essentially, which I think is why the city council central staff can sometimes sound a little testy in their memos, including the memo that got some press this week where they took the mayor to task for setting up her own handpicked team to begin a process all over again to allocate money to BIPOC communities, a process that's already been going on for months between the city council and community groups in the Black community, trying to identify what programs should get more money and more funding. So, and the council central staff said last week in one of their memos, why duplicate the work? You know, you're essentially insulting the Black community by saying, you know, that you're ignoring all the work that's already been done. Let's just do it all over again.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's my wrap up, and I'll cover specific amendments as they work their way through the council. The amendments that were laid out this week were just proposed amendments and just the ones that had received three sponsors. The city council will then Teresa Mosqueda will then put together what she thinks is a package that balances, and it will include as many of these amendments as she can fit in into it, and then the city council will go through the amendments one by one and vote on them. So I will cover those as they come up for a vote.
Yeah, I do want to talk about one that has gotten a lot of attention this week, especially mm-hmm. in right-wing media, which is Lisa Herbold's proposal to expand the definition of duress for misdemeanor crimes, you know, that go to trial or go to a judge, to include duress for having committed that alleged crime for reasons of mental health issues, for reasons of addiction, or for reasons of poverty. And of course, this is the Dory Monsons of the world are having a field day with this. And really misrepresenting it. This is a defense that is available to defendants. It does not mean that the crimes that you get off scot-free, it still goes before a judge, and it needs to go in conjunction with other proposed amendments that would expand mental health programs, would expand addiction counseling, et cetera, and the COVID relief things that Maria was talking about. So
those amendments are in the budget, by the way. There are plenty of amendments to try to expand those services.
Yeah, so in that context, that makes a lot of sense because it helps with the backlog that is being created through COVID-19 and the resulting poverty and the court closures as well. So a way to streamline the courts would be very helpful. And as well, these misdemeanors are frequently the sort of things where that's a more appropriate response than jail time. So it'll be interesting to see how the council deals with that going forward.
And there's been a lot of misrepresentation of that amendment too, saying that, you know, this change would mean that judges have to and prosecutors have to dismiss these charges. And that's not the case at all. The judges would have a great deal of discretion. So if they dismiss a misdemeanor against a defendant and they see that person back in their court again, they can say, okay, this time we're taking it seriously. We can't have you doing this over and over again. You know,
yeah,
even though
exactly.
You've been through, you know, there are resources that we referred you to and you haven't taken advantage of them. You know, judges have a great deal of discretion in these cases. So it would not be a get out of jail free card. Some folks have also asked what you know, how would this affect these businesses that are suffering from a lot of shoplifting, particularly businesses in the downtown core? And, you know, what restitution would there be for victims of these, you know, petty crimes if the perpetrators get off the hook? Well, I think the answer to that is, you know, what do the victims get now? You know, by jailing people for petty crimes and then seeing those people back out on the street once they've served their time and unable to get a job and unable to find housing and once again reoffending. I think if people can get diverted through LEAD or other programs into treatment for drug addiction, into treatment for mental health issues, into job training programs if they're having trouble finding a legitimate job, then that will be a much better system for everyone, including the victims of these petty crimes, particularly these property crimes. Right. We should see a decrease in property crimes, I think, under this type of scenario.
All right. Moving on, earlier this week, King 5 aired a segment on local protesters that didn't sit well with people.
No, this was Thursday night, and the King 5 Investigates program took a look at who are these people who are protesting on the streets of Seattle. And it basically promised in its on-air and social media promotion of it under King 5 Investigates to identify people, to dox people. Now, this is something that is a no-no in social media etiquette. It's something that the right wing tries to do a lot with protesters. And for the dimmer bulbs in the right wing arena, who are legion, this was basically an open invitation to do the same, because the King 5 investigation was something that I could do in 10 minutes on a laptop. It's basically looking at the public records for who's been arrested during the BLM protests over the summer. And the actual segment on King 5 wasn't as bad as it promised to be, because aside from a couple people that they interviewed on camera who were willing to do that, foolishly, I think, they basically talked about trends in the aggregate, that a lot of people that were arrested were Seattle residents. They weren't from out of town or you know, being shipped around the Northwest or whatever. You know, they weren't getting checks from George Soros. So, But the idea of trying to publicly identify individuals who have been arrested at these protests has a couple of serious problems. One is one of safety, because the protests have been confronted by right-wing vigilantes, I won't say routinely, but frequently throughout the summer. And that's just an open invitation. And it's an open invitation that threatens the safety of individual people. Particularly, this is problematic because SPD has been arresting people frequently with no cause, and then the charges have been dropped. But their arrest is still a matter of public record, unless it's been expunged, which is usually not the case. So it really threatens individual lives because it's an invitation for other people in the audience to do the same thing they did, which is not very difficult at all. It really was one of the more shockingly irresponsible things I've seen local media do in Seattle over the years. And it's kind of surprising, because King 5 has, or at least has had, a reputation as a little fairer, a little less biased than some of the other TV outlets in town, especially Como, which is a Sinclair outlet, of course. So, shame on King 5. There's been protests outside their studios for a couple days now. And yeah. I expect those will continue this weekend.
And you know, I don't think that going and rifling through arrest records would have been the right way to do that if you wanted to do like a demographic study of who the protesters are. Typically, the way to do that is you go to a demonstration and you interview people who want to talk to you.
Which very few of the,
have
of
been
the
doing.
TV stations, yeah, have been doing, at least since the early days of the protests.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's just sheer laziness to not do that. And, you know, it may also be because anytime mainstream media people show up at a demonstration, they get tear gassed along with everybody else, and nobody likes that, right?
Or but protesters frequently refuse to talk to them, too.
Yeah, but that should be part of the story. And again, if they refuse to talk to the mainstream media, why isn't that a story?
Yeah.
Right. And the reasons why.
Yeah. And when local media have been the focus of protests, I know there were some protests at Como's studios earlier this year. The station's usual impulse is not to cover them or to ignore them, because then they would have to explain why people were protesting.
Right. Or they'd have to ask people, why are you protesting? And they just don't want to know. They don't want to know.
Yep.
And they don't want to hear criticism of Sinclair Broadcasting, the right wing Sinclair Broadcasting, their parent company.
Moving on. Thursday, there was another police killing in Vancouver, Washington.
Yeah, in Clark County. This hasn't gotten a lot of attention up here yet, although it's been big news in Southwest Washington and Portland. There was a shooting Thursday night of a young 21-year-old African-American man named Kevin Peterson Jr. He was shot in the parking lot of a U.S. bank in a north neighborhood of Vancouver called Hazel Dell. The Clark County Sheriff's Department, which was responsible for the killing, has really not said a lot publicly yet. They finally identified the victim yesterday. Of course, we all knew it Thursday night because his family was literally at the scene of the shooting, talking with reporters. The circumstances are very unclear as well. The statement as of yesterday from the Clark County Sheriff's Office was that they were called because there was a report of suspected drug dealing going on in the parking lot. Of course, you know, that doesn't require a death penalty, and according to witnesses, it escalated very quickly. That, again, this is according to witnesses, police cruisers showed up in the parking lot, and within seconds there were shots fired, and the young man was shot in the back with his hands in his pockets as he was walking away from the officers. Now, there could have been a lot of reasons for that, anything from his having earbuds in to whatever, but it clearly escalated very, very quickly. And the officers who fired the deadly shots have not been identified. Any internal disciplinary action while the shooting is investigated has not been specified. The investigation is being conducted by another police department, the Camas Police Department, which is a suburban police department, which doesn't Camas is a relatively small town east of Vancouver, so that doesn't inspire a lot of confidence either. Portland protesters have gone up to Vancouver the last couple of nights because of this, and there's been additional unrest because of these shootings. This, I think, is likely to escalate certainly tonight. So keep an eye on that situation. It's also likely to get some national attention.
On to national news and the...
It's been pretty quiet nationally.
Yeah. Footage of Amy Coney Barrett taking...
She is on the Supreme Court. She will be there for another 30 years or so. The silver lining is that you've got three of the conservative bloc are over 65 years of age right now. John Roberts is 72. Clarence Thomas is only 70. It seems like he should be much older than that. And
Clarence Thomas.
No, I'm sorry.
Clarence Thomas officiated at the second potential super spreader event at the White House, which was the swearing in of Amy Coney Barrett.
Yes. So that would put him in danger.
Yeah, he may be in danger.
Roberts is 65, and then Alito is the other one who's over 70. So, you know, we've got probably 10 years of a solidly conservative court. Since that court seems mostly about overturning previous precedent, that I think the chances that their decisions are going to stand the test of time are not very good.
It doesn't help us in this era,
but
no, it makes it more important, I think, that Democrats work hard to gain and retain control of the presidency and Congress, because suing a Republican president or a Republican Congress or suing to overturn bills passed by a Republican Congress is going to be that much harder.
Yeah. And I would add to that that the state legislative races this year are critically important also, because they'll determine redistricting for the next 10 years. And since the existing conservative court had already said that gerrymandering is just fine, you're seeing a lot of that in Republican states. That is why not just the Senate, but the House is not representative of the majority of the country, because, you have states like Wisconsin where 55% of the Democrat electorate is Democratic, and 2/3 of the state legislature in Wisconsin and a majority of their congressional seats as well are Republican. That's why. And they've had that built in advantage since 2010. And it's going to get much worse this year unless Democrats can make some inroads into state legislatures. Fortunately, Washington State is a state where that process is not up to the state legislature. It's a bipartisan commission that determines it. So it's a much better system. But we don't have that in a lot of states.
Yeah, and it would be great if we had a national law specifying that it has to be a bipartisan commission in each state, right? Or perhaps a national bipartisan commission that does it state by state.
Yeah, either way, that would be an excellent.
That would be an improvement, and it would be one good thing to push for.
Yep.
All right. So locally, we're having good turnout for the election so far. And it appears that nationally that is lining up as well.
Yeah, we're seeing remarkable voter turnout in states with early voting, which at this point is a majority of states. Most notably Texas, where Harris County, which is where Houston is, has already exceeded not just its early voting totals for 2016, but its entire turnout for 2016. And that's particularly notable because the state of Texas has been trying very hard to restrict early voting in Harris County. We talked a couple weeks ago about court rulings that upheld state that each county could only have one drop-off box. Well, Harris County, population-wise, is more than twice the size of King County. And to have only one voter drop box for the entire county in a sprawling county with a huge metropolis almost entirely contained in it is insane. But people have been waiting for hours, either for drop boxes with their cars or in early voting polling locations, to vote up to 10 hours. And the turnout has been consistently remarkable. The entire state of Hawaii also already exceeded its 2016 voting totals. And people are estimating that by Tuesday, before Tuesday even starts, the whole country will have reached 100 million people who have cast their ballots.
Which is about a third of the population of the United States.
It's more than half the number of registered voters. Mm-hmm. It's already at 88 million, and it's expected to reach 100 million by the end of Monday. So it's really been a remarkable turnout. That turnout probably favors Democrats, but we don't really know. And polling can't really be trusted because, you know, the polling is trying to account for the large turnout. But since it doesn't have any past elections that have been like this, either with the number of early votes, the number of absentee or mail-in ballots, the number of overall votes, modeling is really difficult, and we won't know until afterwards how accurate the modeling was. That being said, there are it's not just the presidential race where the polls have been significant. It's been a little bit of a mixed bag. It's gotten a little bit closer in places like Florida and North Carolina, but mostly it's been going Biden's way nationally in different battleground states. But particularly races for control of the Senate have been very favorable for the Democrats. We've got a number of different states, North Carolina, Georgia, Arizona, Colorado, Maine, where the Democrat is heavily favored, and a number of states that weren't expected to be in play that apparently are, that are either that are within the margin of error one way or the other. South Carolina, Kentucky, those being Lindsey Graham and Mitch McConnell's races.
Kansas.
Texas.
Montana.
Kansas, Montana, Texas, Alaska. So the Democrats have a number of paths to an Electoral College victory and a number of paths to control of the Senate. The Republicans have very few paths. They have to have a lot of things break their way, and it's really pretty late in the game now for October surprises, since this is the last day of October. We got one business day to go. So the Republicans have tried various October surprises. They've fizzled, particularly the Hunter Biden stuff, because the Trump administration simply has no credibility with mainstream media right now. So hang on. It'll be interesting.
Yeah.
And I'll be live blogging it Tuesday night and doing some video check-ins with different organizations that are also doing watch parties. We'll be talking about it probably most of the show next week.
Next week, yep.
All right.
Okay. Assuming Trump hasn't nuked the West Coast by then.
We laugh, but oh
yeah, no, he's capable of anything, and people should be prepared for anything. It's going to be a wild ride.
Well, I don't think he's going to nuke anybody, but I think one thing we should be prepared for is for him to challenge the vote count in a number of states, and I think there are four states in particular where he's going to be really concentrating. Three of those are states that have been considered swing states where it could go either way. The vote could go either way. Those states are Florida, Georgia, and North Carolina.
I put Pennsylvania in that too.
Well, they've been saying Pennsylvania, but I think Pennsylvania is going to go to Biden. But I would guess that is one of the states where, you know, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, those may be states where the Trump team tries to challenge the vote and the ability for those states to count their votes in particular.
I mentioned Pennsylvania because it's been subject to a number of lawsuits already to try and limit voting. So yeah. I think that's on their radar.
Yeah, so those states are definitely on their radar. So those are the states that people should keep an eye on closely if you really care about tracking. Yeah.
Another state where results from November 3rd on. Yeah, another state where there's been a lot of litigation is Arizona.
Yeah. Now, Arizona doesn't have that many electoral votes in comparison to states like Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, Florida, Georgia, North Carolina. Those I'm mentioning the states that have a lot of electoral votes in play. There are other smaller states where it's going to be very close that I don't think the Trump team is going to care as much because they don't have as many electoral votes. That includes Nevada, Arizona, and some other smaller states. So if you like to track elections like a horse race, and it's something you like to spend a lot of time on, those are the states to watch and watch closely, and to make sure. I think those are the ones where you may want to keep track just so that you can talk with your friends and family about why, and your coworkers about why it's important to be active in the street or to be active in making sure that all votes are counted.
One other non-presidential race, or actually set of races, that I would keep an eye on is the state house in Texas. I mentioned the battle over state legislators because of redistricting. Ground zero for that is Texas, where the Democrats think they have a good chance of retaking the state house for the first time in 30 years. And that would make gerrymandering in Texas, which is a huge second most populous state in the country with 30 million people, that would make gerrymandering there much more difficult. So it's a very high stakes race, and the Democrats think they have a shot for the first time in a long time of turning Texas at least partially blue.
Yeah, so, and if the Democrats can win a majority in Texas, that would help them change some of the more repressive voter laws, like the requirement that you have to show ID at the polls. which slows down the voting process and disenfranchises a lot of poor folks, elderly people, and people who are not, not full U.S. citizens from voting. So there's some work to do in Texas in terms of making sure everyone has a franchise.
And a lot of other repressive legislation, too.
Legislation as well, but.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Anything else on that?
Nope.
All right. Returning to a theme we were talking about earlier, Monday there was another police killing of a black man in Philadelphia.
Yeah, and this was a guy named Walter Wallace Jr. He was, I believe, 26 years old. And once again, the circumstances are disputed. The initial police reports were saying that he was coming at officers with a knife when they opened fire at a range of 10 feet, which actually is usually officers are trained to open fire on somebody with a knife at 25 feet because it's easily, it's easy to lunge. Somebody can lunge and attack somebody very quickly. So they're very cautious with somebody with a knife. Well, that wasn't the whole story, according to witnesses, not surprisingly. Wallace was a man with a history of mental illness. His mother was there trying to calm him down when somebody else called police. He was walking toward them, according to witnesses, with a butter knife when they opened fire. And his mother was right there trying to separate him from police. She was trying to de-escalate. They were not. They opened fire again very, very soon after arriving. And this led to a lot of spontaneous protests that night and into the next couple nights, including some looting. And it's a part of a long history of problems with Philadelphia police. Of course, they've been notorious as one of the worst in the country in responding to racial justice protests this summer. The shooting actually happened only about three blocks from where the Move compound was bombed in 1985. Now that neighborhood has been redeveloped since then, but it's still, there are people in that neighborhood who go back that far. There's been a lot of tension with police in West Philadelphia for a long, long time. And that's what resulted in unrest that made the national news this week. Once again, it's hard for the racial justice movement to run out of steam when these incidents keep happening. And you would think that law enforcement agencies would be, sort of on their best behavior for a while just so that the protests might die down a little bit during the winter months. They're not going to die down in the winter months because law enforcement agencies simply aren't taking the cue. The culture seems too ingrained that these kind of questionable shootings keep happening.
It really points to it's not a matter of training. It's not a matter of just making officers aware of the issue. It's a cultural problem. It's something that goes deeper and has a structural problem. Bias is not that easy to get rid of. And institutional racism isn't something that you just tackle by being made aware of it.
Yeah, three-hour training doesn't cut it.
No, it doesn't cover it.
And the other thing is a lot of the impediment to reform efforts in different parts of the country, including here in Seattle, has been the police unions. And the police unions are a reflection of the rank-and-file culture in those departments. Mm-hmm. And until you tackle that culture, which really, the abolition movement has a point here that it's not a reformable institution. It's an institution that has to be completely changed. Including possibly with completely different personnel, because it's just so rooted in the culture, and the culture is so reinforced in the daily work and in the communication between. departments and the people who go between departments, that it really is very difficult to tackle. It's been a problem in Seattle for 30 years at least.
Yeah, there's been a lot of attention locally to the number of people that the Seattle Police Department has lost in the last few months since the City Council started looking at the Seattle Police Department budget and defunding the police and trying to shift focus on as to what sworn officers actually do in the Seattle Police Department. And I think it was Erica Barnett who took a look at who some of these officers were, and she interviewed someone who said that, yeah, a lot of these officers, it turns out, who are leaving are ones who have had complaints sustained against them. So the actual act of trying to restructure policing in our own city is leading to some change and leading to the voluntary leaving of some of the more problematic personnel on the Seattle Police Department.
And you know, if you're leaving a chosen career because you're butthurt because the public doesn't appreciate you, that's addition by subtraction. That's a good thing. That's
yeah. Unfortunately, a lot of these cops are going to other police departments around the state. So that's not necessarily good. It may be good for Seattle. It's not necessarily good for policing in general.
Though. Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
All right. We've got all of 3 minutes left. And Javi, you were talking about some of the international things that appear to demonstrate solutions that we may be incorporating into this country. I saw photos yesterday, amazing turnout in Poland.
In Warsaw.
Yeah, just, I mean, you couldn't even figure out how many people were in those shots.
Yeah, and the protests there were in response to the high court's ruling on abortion, banning abortion in that country. But the organizers are very clear that they don't just want that law changed. They want the government gone. They want a different government. And they're out to topple the government. And that's the scale at which I think we should be thinking if Trump insists in staying in power. You know, their intent is to make the country ungovernable until the government itself falls. And I think that's what we're looking at here as well. Kyrgyzstan, there have been protests there, major protests that at one point involved the occupation of the parliament building over fraudulent elections. We've been talking for months about Belarus and the struggles there and the mass turnouts in the city of Minsk, the capital city there. These are things that are happening in other parts of the world, and we should be paying attention to them. Maria, do you want to run through really quickly for events the list of day after stuff again?
Yes, I can do that. Let me just flip back to that here.
We have 1 minute.
I know. Mobilize and Stand Up America are planning to hold daily marches starting Wednesday, November 4th at 5 p.m. They're convening at Occidental Park in Seattle. Each night, the march will take a different route. Protect the Results is holding a national day of action in Seattle the day after the vote at noon. The location will be announced via text message and email, and you can sign up for those online at mobilize.us. They're also holding a Wednesday, November 4th rally from 3:30 p.m. to 4:30 p.m. at Rainier Avenue South and MLK Way South. Local socialist groups will be holding a Don't Let Trump Steal the Election at Westlake Park the day after the vote, Wednesday, November 4th at 6 p.m. And be prepared for your election night watch parties to maybe head out on the street if Donald Trump makes an announcement when polls close on the East Coast, which he may do. There may be a lot of spontaneous rallies that just happen in your neighborhood. Be prepared and be thinking about what you would do. And please, please, please be nonviolent.
Yeah.
That includes no property destruction. You can shout. You can clap. You can sing. You can march. But please try to be nonviolent.
Yeah. And be aware of counter protesters also.
Yeah. And you know, invite them to join you. I mean, most people can agree on democratic principles, regardless of what candidate they vote for. And sometimes people think, well, you know, my candidate didn't win and he's trying to, he's, you know, and I support, but I support him. You know, that person isn't always somebody who can't be talked to.
Or talked with. Yeah.
Or talked with.
All right. Well, we are out of time and plan to talk with you both again, same time next week.
Yep. If the creek don't rise.
We'll be here.